Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Ran Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Meg Tuitt, author of Three by Tuitt, published by Cowboy Jamboree Press.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a drink while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we are drinking a Demolition Derby, inspired by Meg's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Meg Tuitt is the author of numerous books and chapbooks of literary fiction and poems. Her writing has appeared in journals including Berkeley Fiction Review, 34th Parallel, Epiphany, JMWW, Monkey Bicycle, and others. She has been nominated several times for the Pushcart Prize. Of her work in the book we feature today, Three by Tuitt, acclaimed author and BookTales alum Amber Sparks says, quote, "Meg Tuitt writes these stories like secret storms. You won't notice until after how wrecked the lawn of your brain has become as the stories sneak up and roll over you in the best way. Tuitt's characters are the bravest, frightened animals caught out in a bright light, their beautiful, terrible choices exposed and devastated."
Three by Tuitt includes three outstanding works from Meg Tuitt: the chapbook, Her Skin is a Costume, the novel and stories, Domestic Apparitions, and the short story collection, Bound in Blue. Her Skin is a Costume is a collection of short fiction with character studies, dark humor, and a poetic language twist. Domestic Apparitions is a searing reflection of narrator Michelle's childhood and life. And in Bound by Blue, Tuitt sparkles darkly with dense poetic prose, also resembling a hidden knife or gag in the deepest shade of indigo. At the heart of Tuitt's work is memory, specifically often the memory of sexual trauma. Three by Tuitt contains powerful stories told in lyric prose that will remain with you long after you finish the book.
How are you doing today, Meg?
I am doing great, and I'm so happy to be here with you.
Yay!
We're excited too.
This for a while, and I love that my drink is about a demolition.
Yes,
really sense.
That's the most custom drink we've ever made. Yeah, well, we're super looking forward to talking with you about your work and also having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. And I used to, when I first started, it was like I was frightened by it. I was horrified that I had to do this shit because I grew up in a household where you were told to shut up. And I did quite well. And I was just a reader. I just kept to myself. And of course, then I got into trouble once I found drugs and alcohol. But besides that, that's when I found my voice, I think. But now over time, I mean, it's been like, I don't know how many years of publishing, probably 12 or so, maybe more. And so many readings, as you know, with AWP and all the different places we go. So I really never say no to a reading at this point.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting, like the difference between your initial relationship with giving readings and how you feel after you've done a ton of more of them.
Yes.
I think my strategy has kind of shifted. Has your strategy for reading shifted? Because I know what I thought I was trying to do when I first started to get up and give readings is not the same as what I'm now doing.
Well, I can't even believe you did audios of your books, which I think is so cool. I don't know if I would be able to keep my voice moving that long. Like usually, like we were talking before, we usually do shorter readings. The ones in Bound by Blue are longer. So I have a video of me reading, I don't know, like a 20-minute story or something. But I think that's the longest. I mean, I have read longer, but a bunch of different short pieces throughout.
Yeah.
Meg, can you talk about your process of creating this book? How did the collections come together for you? And what was your process of putting it all together?
Well, they were all different period pieces. Domestic Apparitions was my first collection. And it was really funny because I had gone to Tin House for a workshop and I was working with Dorothy Allison, who we love and all of us know. And I brought the most non-Dorothy Allison piece you could bring. It was about an intellectual couple trying to get to know each other who are both insiders, University of Chicago, brilliant kids who were trying to come together from some website. And it was called Couple, and people hated it. And she came to me and said, wow, I cannot believe, because we did one-on-ones with her later, and she, not everyone hated it. There were a few that loved it, but she was just like, I can't, you blew me away because it's so not me. It's like, I write about down-home, crazy shit, motherfucking, you know, wild stuff. Now, they were wild and they had great dialogue, I thought. So what I did was I decided to cut it up when I got home into like 5 pieces. And within 5 days, all 5 were published.
Oh, wow.
And from then on, it's not stopped. You know, it just pretty much keeps going.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I had always written longer. I was like Heather. I wrote longer pieces. You write shorter too, but I don't know about you, Rand, but I know Heather is very prolific and extremely, once she gets going, it's like an opera that's 300 pages. I don't even know how the fuck you do that.
I don't either, Meg. Oh, crazy.
Truly crazy and amazing. And truly, she can go into any area and make it happen. It's so great.
Yeah.
Whereas mine started to dwindle and dwindle and dwindle until I was really moved from kind of a narrative structure. Not that there still isn't narrative, but poetic prose is really my angle now.
Mm. I've really done a lot with the flash genre too. I mean, these very dense, but compact. They have a lot in them. That's its own skill and its own fascinating thing. How do you feel about, let's say, the difference between prose poetry and flash fiction? Are they kind of linked for you?
Well, I teach a lot of people that are doing flash.
Yeah.
But I think that I just, like, I love Gariel Lutz. I don't know if you know her work, but it's gorgeous. Every sentence is its own universe, is what she says. And I agree. It's come more down to that. And then what I realize is that the people that I really loved reading, like Bruno Schultz from Poland and Janet Frame from New Zealand, both in the 30s and 40s, Kate Braverman, who I got to hang out with before she died out here, Clarice Lispector, Ocean Vuong, is that I wanted to, whatever I was going to do, even if it was a long format, it was going to be based on sentence by sentence by sentence. And I had teachers who even said, if you put 2 good sentences on every page, that's enough. And I thought to myself, what the fuck are you talking about? I don't really get that in my mind. In my mind as a writer, it's like, why can't we utilize a craft? Like, would you tell a pianist that? Like, okay, throw out 2 great scenarios during this composition and that's good. It didn't make sense to me. And then I started to read people like Djuna Barnes. Oh my God, I love her.
I do too.
People that really, really work their sentences. And did you ever read Miss McIntosh, My Darling by Marguerite Young out of Canada? Oh my God. That was based on a woman who was on opium, who had people coming to her house constantly, and for her child, they didn't exist. But for her, they were real. And it's like 2 volumes, took her 20 years to write. It is so beautiful, the language. Oh my God, gorgeous.
When you were saying 2 good sentences per page, is that what you had said? My first thought was, does that mean all the other ones can suck?
No, the other ones have to drive the narrative. And then 2 of them, right. Well, I agree with you. I was like, what the fuck is your problem? I don't want to read anything you write. Yeah, but there's a difference between, and I see time as time passes, from 20th century writing into 21st century writing, and now moving in to where we are past the pandemic, it is really changing a bit. I'm not talking about genre writing, but I'm talking about how to move a narrative. Like Ocean Vuong is a perfect example of that, I think.
Yeah, and we were just talking recently with Jen Mikalski, and she was talking about how the modern age has created a necessity for shorter stories, like how we used to write maybe in the 90s or in the early 2000s, 5,000 word stories were very common that you would try to publish. But now she's saying 2 to 3K is more hitting the sweet spot. And it's maybe it's people's attention spans are shorter. Maybe it's that the online format just lends itself to shorter pieces a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's because readers these days they tend to read things that are smaller. And so they don't have the habit or expectation for the longer read.
But basically, they're idiots. Is that what you're saying? No, I agree in some way.
Yeah, their literacy has gone down in America clearly since the time that Martin Luther King was giving his speeches to sanitation workers, because now those speeches go over the head of a lot of the American public.
And they don't even want to know about history. It isn't want to move forward. I know people that will only read, and people you'd be surprised by as writers, who haven't read anything by anyone who's dead. They only read like what's out there. That's it.
Yeah. Like, whereas myself, I'm like the sixth sense of literary reader. I'm like, I only read dead people most of the time.
Well, that's how I was for a while. When I first really got into it, I was only reading dead writers because I was in Montreal and I would go to the library, sixth floor of a French library. And that's where they had all the English books. And I would just read like Robert Louis Stevenson, and like I would read Goethe and different people from different, but they were all in English, and that's all I read and that's all they had. So for 3 years I was there, that's all I read every day that I wrote.
Yeah, it's really interesting because that's part of the reason that Ran and I decided to do this podcast, is because I said I'll read then at the minimum 12 living writers per year.
Right. I love that you have a count on it. You're like, okay, I've already done the dozen, so now I got to go back to the dead.
That's it.
Then I can get back in my Nabokov, coma there, over there. So this is really good. We're talking about, and interesting that we're talking about how people read these days and how it's impacting the creative work that's created. Because this feeds right into a question I was just about to ask you, which is, how does your awareness of a reader factor in your process, if it does at all?
Oh God, yes. You mean in terms of what you read
in terms of when you're writing or when you're picking what to read at a reading, but more so when you're thinking of who are you speaking to when you're creating the work.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, I have to have inspiration around me. And I've noticed from the workshops that I've gone to, where I went to Ellen Bass and Dorian Locks and Joe Millar. I worked with them at Esalen, and this is a good story. I don't know how Robert will feel about it, but it's funny. Robert Vaughn and I were sharing a room together, and I have to write inside is what I saw, because I have to surround myself by all mostly poetry books, even though I'm writing prose. And finally, one day, he knocked on the door because we were sharing a room, and he said, "Jesus, Meg, I need to masturbate. Could you leave for like 10 minutes?
Oh, my gosh.
And then come back?" And I was like, "Oh, God, 10 minutes? The class is in like 20. You better get on it, dude. Okay, I'll meet you back. I'll be back." So I didn't know I was keeping poor Robert from what he needed to do. But I literally spent all my time, and it was Esalen is beautiful. I don't know if you've been there, but it's gorgeous. But I still had to write indoors. And so I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what inspires me for the most part. And I now am reading Bruno Schulz's latest translation, which is really exciting because there's a new Kafka, there's a new Bruno Schulp. They're coming back around with new translations of people that I love. So I'm checking them against what I read before to see how they stand up.
Yeah.
And that's always
fun. Because translations are so pivotal to whether or not you even like the work. It's like night and day, a good translation and a bad translation, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I wrote to Benjamin Moser, who was translating Clarice Lispector. And I wrote to him one morning after I'd found her and started to read her. And I said, I have to tell you, you've changed my entire life. And I cannot thank you enough for what you've done to bring her to us. And he wrote back and said, do you know how few people even think of the translator? He was so ecstatic. And I was like, God, you're the first one I thought of was like, oh my God, this person brought Clarice Lispector into my life. And a lot of what I read is not Americans.
Yeah.
So you've written novels, short story collections, novellas. Do you know when you start if a story is going to be what form it's going to take? Do you have a sense of that when you start, or does it just become that?
Yeah, I have no idea. No idea. Although, I mean, there is one I'm sitting on, Heather knows about. That's a novel I've been working on probably on and off for 10 years. It's now probably 12 years because I keep saying 10 and years keep passing. So God knows how many fucking years it is. But I don't really know. I do know with White Van, I knew that they were going to be short poetic pieces because it was such disturbing material that I thought, what would be the best format for this? So I thought that that would work best.
Right.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah. And something that's really wonderful about you, Meg, which I've noticed is you have been involved in so many different and fun literary projects, workshops, editor positions, all kinds of things, and publishing, reading your own work. I think because of the vastness of your experience in that, I'm just curious, is there a special or favorite experience you've had so far in terms of your writing life?
I mean, there are moments like I was reading, which I could read today also because it's in Bound by Blue. It's titled Creep. And I was reading it to an audience. And all of a sudden I saw this guy like sobbing in the back. So afterwards, you know, I went up to him and he's like, do you know that you just wrote my fucking dad? Every single part of that. And he was this Native American, beautiful, amazing guy. And he said, you know what, I have been so blocked and I am now going to write my memoir. And I was like, first of all, I'm sorry that Creep reminded you of your father because that's upsetting. But secondly, wow, what a thing to get from somebody.
Oh, yeah. Well, I noticed that family trauma and dysfunction is a powerful theme in a lot of your stories. And
right.
You often portray families in a really brutal way, brutally honest. And I was wondering if there's any point when you're drafting the story, if you feel like you need to lighten it a bit or pull back, or do you just keep going?
I do. I don't want to pull back. And yeah. I always tell people there's enough milk toast out there to last us a fucking lifetime.
And that is true.
20 of them. And Heather, I know, agrees too. And I'm sure you do too as well from what you read. Come on. There's so much abuse. There's so much stuff going on out there. And we don't know because the world is so messed up. I mean, I've had people say to me, I had one I told Heather where they had written to me, I think it was Kirkus Review, that I wouldn't know a happy ending if I saw one. And she and I think, Heather, you said, that's great. No, it was Paula Bomer. Was
what a compliment.
She's like, that's awesome. That's so good. Let's put that in there. And I was like, I'm not quite sure this was really supposed to be a good review. I don't know. But I mean, when you look out there, if you think about the Disney-like aspect of some people, I have to say, not that everything is negative, God, no. But if we don't work through our shit, then what are we doing here? It doesn't make sense to me.
Oh, yeah. And there's something that's really continuously and constantly authentic in a voice like yours, Meg, because you don't hold back. You don't pull the punch. You let the story go dark. And that's an aspect of style that's absolutely identifying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because your work keeps that line of authenticity by you refusing to dilute it. But I'm surprised about the reviews that come in of your work? Do you ever?
No, I'm not at all. I mean, I'm surprised when other people think they're good. They're like, "Ooh, yeah, that's great." And I'm like, "Are you sure? Are you sure you don't want to read that again before you decide to include that?" Like, I mean, I had one. Well, here, I'll read it from 3x2. Okay, this one is just a short one from Brian Allen Ellis. Okay. Do you know him?
Yes.
Yeah. Meg Tuitt is like Sissy Spacek in the movie Carrie when they dump pig blood on her. But instead of setting the prom on fire, she ignites your brain using dark and mysterious word torches.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Very poetic.
Wow, it's right. When I got it back, I had to look at it a few times and think, well, should I add that or should I keep that one out? But I love him, so of course I added it.
Well, yeah. One of the stories that I loved was Garbage Picker of Memory.
Oh, yeah.
I just love that story so much. And I'm always really interested in the idea of memory and perspective, and you deal with it so well in the story.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the different kinds of oppression of the women in the story and how they impact them, especially Lucy and Rita, their abilities to remember and tell stories both early and later on.
I don't know so much. I start out memory as a marauder. So the sisters are both considered crazy, but they're certainly not in my mind. But their husbands at that point in time were able to sign them away. And one of them is so quiet that she can't really function in the world. And the other one screams and yells so loudly that people think he's murdering her in the car as he's rushing to get her to emergency room or wherever. And they come around through their own children, I think, to realize that these are stories they need to tell, that they haven't really told them. But they tell them to each other, even to the point where the one who's so quiet, they're just two old women sitting on a porch. And the other one is riding buses all day. And through collecting stories from what would be considered strangers, she finds her own history, I believe, and tells it to her sister. And now they're talking.
Right. So well done.
It's so interesting. I love particularly reading female authors who develop the complexity in the relationships between women in their work.
Yes.
That's something that always makes me feel happy, because I think more of that could stand to be out there.
Well, you're doing that.
Oh, thank you.
You're making that happen.
Well, you know, one story at a time, one piece at a time.
Oh, no, not for you, Heather. 40 pieces at a time, I think.
Oh, no.
Remind me of the woman, Thomas Wolfe, who has like this trunk of millions of pages, I can imagine, that are just inside this trunk.
Yeah,
millions.
But you know what? I really need to stop writing and spend more time trying to get publishers for the work that I'm sitting on, because that becomes a little voluminous and overwhelming sometimes.
I know, that's a whole nother job. It's so hard.
You know, and then life just intervenes. Exciting different things in life are happening, and you go, oh yeah, I want to do underwater basket weaving. You know, so speaking of which, and this is something that you do that I want to call out in this podcast, just because you're so artistic. Can you share with us the other artistic interests you have aside from writing? And what would be your definition of a perfect art day?
Jesus, Heather, you're giving me way more than I'm worth. I barely want to get out of bed some days. I mean, it's really something I think about before I do. Let's see. I've honed it into writing when I can. Like this weekend, I'm working a Bending Genres online workshop on weather with Wendy Olison. And it's so much fun because I need deadlines in order to create. You're much more on it in that way than I am. But I order so many goddamn books. And if I drink at night a little bit, oh, forget it. I forget it. And then all of a sudden they all arrive in the mail. I mean, I got a book, 3 of the same book, because I loved it so much.
You really did.
You got to be fucking kidding. That was serious wine night. So, you know, yeah.
Didn't you at one time make these extremely, I always think of you in such vivid and colorful, beautiful colors, because every image of, you know, your place and all of the things that you did.
the collages that I used to do.
Yeah, didn't you used to do some sort of textile thing? Like, I don't know, I've maybe made t-shirts or you did something with very colorful stuff. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. I was in Montreal and I don't know how, I mean, I was young, so I had all this energy for all this shit. And I would write for 5 hours a day. I would spend at least 5 hours at the library, and that would be reading and writing. And then I would go home and I would go to like the dollar store and get all this cardboard and shit and paints and, you know, like kindergarten stuff, bring it home, and then just start whipping out all the like portraits of the writers that I loved was the beginning. And then it went into this friend of mine there said, let's take these and try to sell them. And I said, you got to be kidding me. I was giving them out to friends, you know, if they wanted, if they told me, oh, can you make so-and-so? And I'd be like, all right. And I really enjoyed doing that. I don't know when it stopped. It turned into t-shirts and they were sold all over. I mean, like national, but I never make money. I don't know. I need to turn that around. Now, I make a ton of money. And like you do that, Heather, and Rand, you probably do that too. I am not really good at visualizing in that area, but yeah, it was fun. And I loved doing it. And I did t-shirts for everybody. But yeah, those days are gone.
Well, I have a writing question and I'm curious about what your revision process is. Can you just walk us through once a draft is done, then what's next?
I work so hard on those first drafts that for me, it's probably a 20 draft because every sentence, yeah. I can't get past it if I think it's a piece of shit. But it used to not be that way. It used to be right. Drafts, draft, 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 sit on it, draft, draft, draft. Now I really spend time with each sentence. So therefore, I don't even think it's a first draft by the time I'm finished with it.
And do you think it's at like 10,000 hours of mastery too? I mean, at this point, you've spent so long writing and revising.
Yeah, I think reading too, with all the reading we do, it really, for me, I think that's the most important is to make time for that. Even though I've heard some writers tell me, oh, I don't have time to read. I just don't have time to read. And I'm like, isn't that part of what we're doing? Like, if you don't have time to read, isn't that who we learn from? I've always found books to be more teachers for me than any teacher out there that I've had.
Agreed.
Yeah. The best thing a teacher can do for me is tell me, go out and get Juna Barnes right now. And I do. I'm like, okay, I'm on it. And then I'm so thankful that they did that because I'm like, oh, yeah. And so that's what I feel even as a teacher myself is the best I can do is get them excited about what they're doing or get them to risk.
Yeah.
And it's such a wide swath and it's so good when people have read extensively because then their field that they can play from is so much bigger, right? I mean,
yes.
What you're doing with your work can just become so much deeper and more nuanced and more layered and more interesting on a lot of levels. So I love reading work from people who are well-read. Whenever people tell me that they don't read, but yet they're a writer, I always think,
Yes, I had a student once who wanted to write screenplays. And she said, well, I have never read a book. And I said, come on, you're like 18. You've never read one book? She's like, well,
question to her would be, how many thousands of screenplays have you read then?
None. She had read none. She said, I watched tons of movies. I said, yeah. Where do you think those movies come from?
Wow. I'm always amazed because I'm doing screenwriting right now too. I'm always amazed.
It's hard. I
watch movies.
I'm truly amazed that you can do all these different arenas. I can't even imagine. And to have someone say, oh, but I want to write screenplays, but I don't want to read them. I was like, I don't think I can even teach you. I don't know what I can do for you except go to the library.
Yeah. Well, when COVID came, I decided to do this UCLA year-long program in professional screenwriting because you got to have something to do when you're stuck in your house in COVID. And it was wonderful. But now the first thing I do is go read the screenplay. If I love the movie, I always want to know How much did they put on the page? How did this happen there? How much work did the director do making this excellent? Is it really the actors who propelled this film into being great, or was it something in the seed of what was on the page? It's so fascinating. But back to you, because today is you. This is your focus. Rand,
Heather,
can you
I just have to tell you, I keep seeing you. I always have, like, you're in a period piece for me. Like, I see you in this long gown.
Oh.
But you're one of those women who was, like, fighting the powers that be and was not one of those, you know, little ditzy women running around in their outfits. You liked the outfits, but you were, like, doing operas and making things happen all over the place. I really have always seen you that way.
I love that. That's so great.
That's awesome. Thank you. And I would like to dress that way.
I know. And you do sometimes, by the way. You have some great gowns.
I know. I have no shame. I'm very extra. But right now, let's have Ran tell us about today's drink for your book.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's pretty delish. Today's booktail cocktail is called a Demolition Derby. The recipe is on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 1 ounce of whiskey, 1 ounce of gin, 1 ounce of lemon juice, 1 ounce of maraschino liqueur or juice, 1 ounce of simple syrup, and 2 ounces of soda. You mix everything but the soda in a shaker with ice. Give it a shake. Pour in a glass filled with ice and top with a soda and a little bit of lime zest for garnish. To make it a zero-proof cocktail, use zero-proof whiskey and gin, and it's just as delicious.
Yum. Wow. Meg, would you like to tell us a little bit about the excerpt you've selected to read today?
Well, I picked out a few shorties.
Awesome.
From each book, I think I did. So let's see. The first one is from Her Skin is Costume. And it's a one-sentence story called Theft. I don't want all the necklaces from the store rack that I slip into my coat pocket, the size of a rural mailbox, but definitely want friends to notice that I'm not as afraid as the tremors that spread across my face, like the makeup and lipstick palmed in my hand that will only make imperfections brighter, more shrill when one of my friends gets too close and whispers secrets about other girls that could have been my pimples, flat chest, crazy thoughts. Secrets that Mom tells me will save me from the captivity of convention, anchor me within my own breed of otherness, keep me from walking within the lines as Mom slips a pen and notebook into my pocket, and goes back to confiscating the wail of wind and strangers' depressed faces, demolished buildings, the bruised colors of my interior with her own silent hell, humming a soft velvet tune that I want to crawl inside, larger than my bulging pocket filled with sparkly trinkets I will hand out to friends at school the next day. That's one. And then Leader of Men, which was the first one when I said that I split up that story. This was in that story four. That turned out to be 5 stories. Leader of Men. Dad was a tall, good-looking man, though his features bore the slight tremor of the frenzied, similar to that strained purposefulness of a dog that has come to the end of its chain but does not agree. He was waving a butcher knife out in front of him while he spoke, and with each thrust, the knife, a bit of a yes man itself, nodded up and down in obvious collusion with Dad, who held it, giving an added force to his words that alone they didn't carry. Mom watched Dad and the knife equally, but said nothing, though her face, exquisite in its own right, said everything. They stood in front of a wounded tomato that Mom had been brutally mutilating before Dad had been able to assess the seriousness of the situation and rush in to salvage it from its complete demise. There the tomato sat in front of them, bleeding to death from its right side, a savage testimony to the woman's complete and utter incompetence. Wrong, Dad said. Wrong, wrong. Wrong. He snatched up the knife quickly, calling a halt to this obscene bloodbath. Was it necessary for him to be everywhere at once? Was there nothing that his wife wouldn't destroy if left to her own devices? Mom understood nothing, absolutely useless. Dad held the knife forcefully and with authority, letting it know immediately that he was in charge now, and it was to do exactly as he said. "Look," he said, "look at the knife. See how I hold it?" It was true. In his hand, the knife was pointed and dangerous. It was a weapon, an extension of himself. Mom's reddened, shriveled hand had reduced the knife to nothing more than a feeble, clumsy thing that fumbled ridiculously with vegetables, pawing them into a slow and painful death. The blade stuttered and hung its head foolishly until it became as dull and lifeless as her tongue. Dad looked over at Mom once more. His eyes rolled together in disgusted formation from one side of his head to the other, but trembling final summation of his entire contempt. And without another moment's hesitation, he gripped the knife like nothing less than a leader of men, and using swift, competent, ruthless strokes, sliced the remaining portion of the tomato that Mom had not been able to deface. Whereupon the tomato ace, also prepared to show her a lesson she would not soon forget, dropped neatly away from each other and lined themselves up efficiently, cleanly, and precisely, like well-trained little soldiers in uniform red. Dad gave her one more derisive look and swaggered out of the kitchen. Mom stared at the tomato and then after Dad. "This is your head," she said. Mom slammed the remains of the tomato against the wall and watched them slide artfully, gracefully, down to the floor. And then I chose Religion, which is a short piece. Every night, my grandmother limps out of a liquor store with the submissive stoop of the genuflected and the promise of a liturgy to come in a bottle. A radiant old face with the slight tremor of the merciful, holding a brown paper bag reverently out in front of her with both hands, as a priest holds his chalice. And what would be the difference? She has been living, breathing, and sucking down the blood of Christ in a lifetime of unparalleled singularity that the clergy can only read about and shamelessly attempt to enact, mouthing their long-winded, incredulous interpretations of the Bible, done up like showgirls in their mawkish vestments. And the last one I was going to read was Creep, which we were talking about earlier. Creep. I study my face in the mirror. It has etched circles of whispering wrinkles that move around like pulling the stopper from the sink, watching water spiral down the drain. Many secrets are buried in these caverns. I survived four wives and brats hover around me that are kids of my kids, and I smile and act like I care. Some of them even look like me, but only one stands out from the mob. Whenever Tori comes around, she gives me the once-over and asks me how many times I've shit my pants this week, and we roar with laughter while the others stand around and fidget with their minds. I don't know where Tori fits in the lineup. I whacked so many of those good-for-nothings over the years. Every one of them will tell you I drank so much malt liquor I could barf up a brewery, and that wouldn't be a lie. I still fed the grubs until they were old enough to legally kick out of the house. Now they've got me where they want me. I'm sitting my fat ass in a wheelchair at some hell camp for all the assholes you'd never want to meet in some cheap, piss-smelling, kill-you-off-slowly home for dying, deranged, broken-down bodies. The first wife took the four iron from my golf bag and beat my kneecaps into a bloody pulp one morning when I was passed out on the living room floor after spending a weekend out with somebody else's wife that she caught wind of. How the hell am I supposed to keep track of whose friend is whose and who's married to whom? I figured these gals would take care of that, and if they were still game, then who was I to interfere? Let me tell you, the pain of that bludgeoning never goes away. in surgery for 5 hours. And after that, I spent 6 weeks plastered on the couch with my legs elevated. And the place where my knees used to be, pulsing a beat inside my head I never wanted to hear or feel again, even with handfuls of the painkillers I sucked down with whiskey and beer. The bitch took me for some serious cash. Thank God my dad bought 2 entire blocks of real estate in Brooklyn way back when it was cheap and a shithole. When the old man died, I took over for him, and that landfill of empty lots and decrepit buildings were being hollowed out and fixed up by all these rich young things, paying me boatloads of rent every month to keep their little boutiques and restaurants and law offices secured in what had suddenly become a prime location. The old man knew what he was doing. I used to walk down those blocks and pick up checks like I was a fucking bank. Beautiful. I had loads of time to play golf and mess around with other guys' wives until I lost a few kneecaps. Had to use a cane after that. Wife number 2 and 3 just got wrinkled and fatter with every kid they wailed out. When sex became a chore with them, I found younger replacements willing to do anything for a nice dinner and a few jewels. What the hell? Wife number 4 was the most memorable. She was the only one who dumped me before I dumped her. She was round in all the right places and could drink as much as me. We had a good time together. Had a few kids and a lot of laughs. I might have kept her if she didn't get sick and die from some brain tumor all within a few weeks. That was crazy. But none of them know a damn thing about me except for Tori. She's tall and thick as a redwood, and we speak the same language. She's shot out of a fat whale number 2 or 3 I called wife. Tori was always quiet when everyone else was blathering, and she laughed when no one else did. I like that in a kid. When I took the belt to her, she'd look me straight in the eye. She'd say, "No, sir, I'll take my beating head on." Damn, she was a beast. So what is it that gets into the bones and jangles them up into a knot of confessionals? Every wrenching pain insists on dragging out some vagrant memory from my spine that knocks off vertebrae like dominoes. I get smaller every day while those flickering corners of my film have set up the projector and keep rolling the tapes. Not enough beer in the world could erase those visuals. One daughter threw a lit cigarette at me, swore up and down about the shit I'd done to her for hours while I sat dead-eyed in my chair. Other daughters came and went screaming all kinds of things. They were older but looked vaguely familiar. Yeah, I remembered going in and out of rooms at night, finding some teenager to fuck with when I was drunk, which was pretty much every night. At least 5 of the kids disowned me, and that saved me some time and cash. A few sons and son-in-laws smacked me in the face for botching up lives they never had a chance at. You get too old to fight back. I'm a creep. I get it. I come from a long line of creeps. I'm sure a few of those sperm banks I launched into this world are creeps as well. So what? The world's full of us with more crawling out every damn day. But it's Tori that rewinds before me. She barrels into my nondescript room with a window that opens out to a garden I never look at and tells me I resemble the gorilla in that movie, the one that terrorized a city with a blonde crushed between his black hairy paws. "King Kong," she screams, and we both belt out howling. Tori breaks my heart. She sees something, but it's a something I've never been. She yells and swats at me sometimes, but it's a quiet in her that unnerves me. She can sit with me for what seems like hours and not say a word or blink. She stays when everyone else is running in the other direction. "I got one for you," Tori would say. "How many creeps does it take to screw in a light bulb?" I was always drunk before I was stuck in this hellhole and would stare back with a menacing look that didn't scare her. "Not even one," she'd say. "This creep is so full of his own fireworks that he lights up the room with his farts." And somehow that would set me off and I'd lose the battle that had started in my brain. Tori could break me up and stand strong as a tree trunk in front of me, cackling and shrieking at her own bad joke. And I've always been the bad joke. All those years of terrorizing these bastards that swelled and popped out of their mother's bodies like Jiffy Pop were now imprinted in my face. Every child was another ruptured capillary on my double-wide flame-flaring snout. Tori sits in front of me and hollers, "You're an old fool with half a brain and didn't even have to get a lobotomy." She slaps her thigh and smacks my scrawny bald head. I wander through the halls of my fingerprints and know they have imprinted Tori with far more than a dusting. I look down into those narrowed eyes more than a few times and never wavered as I pumped that kid full of sperm. I see her pregnant at some point in time, long before her time. She had my fucking baby. I don't know which one of those screaming grandkids is actually mine. "Tori," I say, clutching my chest, like a demented halfwit with tears slithering down my cheeks. Tori narrows her eyes and studies me. "Look, you old creep," she says. "You're like a bad penny that keeps turning up. Who gives a shit about a penny anymore? You think I'm going to pick you up?" I stare at her in horror. She stares back with that ominous silence that seems like the long, dark tunnel that the rest of my spawn tell me I'm marching toward. I get ready for whatever she's going to give me or not. She sits down in her chair and starts fishing through her pockets. She pulls out a handful of pennies and starts whipping them at me, one by one. Then when I am covered and surrounded by coins, she throws back her head and lets out that deep, guttural roar that always gets me going. I get it. I'm a waste case. Always have been. I shake my bald, shriveled head and start to snicker along with her. That's it.
That was great. That was so good. I love the selections you chose.
Oh, thank you so much, Ran.
Yeah, what intense pieces. That was so great. I really enjoyed hearing several pieces in a row. Thank you for sharing your reading with us.
Thank you so much for letting me do that. This has been so much fun.
Of course. We have just a few last questions that we would love for you to answer.
Absolutely.
This is one that we often ask our BookTales folks, because we want to know what's coming up. What's next in the pipeline? Do you have any new projects or artistic directions slated in the coming up years that you can tell us about?
Well, I love chapbooks, as you know. I have 5 of them. I do love them. And I always try to do a chapbook in between a collection or a book. So I have one out at a couple places, and I'm waiting to hear back. And it's about 60 pages or so of different, once again, intense stories. But what I did was I used quotes from different people like Clarissa Spector, like Lucia Berlin, Henry Darger, all these different, interesting, weird people that I've loved for so long. So I quote them and then I try to write something that relates to their life in some way with poetic prose. So that's what I did with that one.
That sounds amazing.
Thank you.
We have one last question, and that is, what advice would you offer new writers?
Oh, get to the library. It's all free.
Read those books.
It's the only place where you can go where they're not trying to sell anything. You can hang all day. People who are homeless can hang there. I mean, it's beautiful. I've always loved libraries. My mother was a librarian. And she was brilliant. And yeah, a library is a great thing. People don't have to buy books. They can go to the library.
I love the library. I check out books from the library all the time still.
I know.
Me too. And like last weekend, I just donated 98 books to our library that's up the road from me.
Wonderful.
Yeah. You are brave.
So
I can't let go of hardly any books. I did one time where I got 12 boxes together, but you know, I'm still buying. So it's insane. It's a problem.
Decided I had to Marie Kondo the book situation because I have so many bookshelves in this house and they were all full. Yep. So I said, okay, there's a criteria for keeping the book. Do I ever want to read it again? One. Mm-hmm. Two, do I love it? Is it just something I absolutely love? Three, did right. I buy it with inspiration, intention? Is it something that I know right. I'm going to want to read but haven't read yet? And four, is it sentimental? And if the answer is no, I don't want to read it now and I don't think I'll want to read it later, it left.
That's great. Those are great criteria.
Good job. Yes, I have to remember that.
Thank you.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We enjoy talking with you so much and hearing you read from your work. We really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. I so enjoyed hanging out with you. And I hope I can do it again with you someday.
Yeah, for sure.
I love you, people.
Well, this was our pleasure. And everybody, please go order Meg's book, which is an omnibus. You get three collections in one book, which is great. Three by Tuit. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales, readings, and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.